This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
America's melting pot and the politics of immigration. Hello again, I'm Orrin Almy, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. President Bush is walking a tightrope on immigration, one of America's most basic and emotional issues. He's promising a crackdown at the border. At the same time, he invites illegal immigrants to be part of what he calls a guest worker program. On To The Point, is that comprehensive reform or a contradiction? We'll talk about national security, human rights, social services, and cheap labor. Is there any hope for political consensus? A reporter's notebook later on, are Iraq's new security forces prepared to maintain order in a divided country? First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To The Point. President Bush wants to crack down at the border. At the same time, he creates a so-called guest worker program. On To The Point, is it immigration reform or amnesty for illegal aliens? Can the president build consensus, even in his own Republican Party? On Reporter's Notebook, despite reports of Shiite death squads in local police forces, Secretary Rumsfeld says Iraqis are making progress in providing their own security. First, this news update. The biggest bribery case to hit Congress in 20 years raises troubling questions about the way public money is allocated to defense contractors. California Republican Randy Duke Cunningham has confessed to accepting $2.4 million and evading $1 million in taxes.
The truth is I broke the law, concealed my conduct, and disgraced my office. I know that I will forfeit my freedom, my reputation, my worldly possessions, most importantly, the trust of my friends and family.
Very emotional moment yesterday for Randy Duke Cunningham. He's a decorated fighter pilot from the Vietnam War who was elected to Congress 8 times. The bribes he accepted included Persian carpets, silver candelabras, travel expenses, even a Rolls Royce. David Hawkins is managing editor at Congressional Quarterly. David, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Warren.
The confession by the congressman, yesterday's news, today's news. What did the people who bribed him get in return? How was he able to deliver?
Well, that's sort of the big mystery. If you read the actual paperwork that went along with the plea bargain agreement, it's never precisely specified. The indictment or the plea bargain agreement says that that Duke Cunningham sought to use his influence as both a senior member of Congress. He's actually one of the number four Republican on the committee that essentially writes the defense budget every year. So he has enormous power, but that he used that power both in the congressional spending and budget process and to curry favor with the Pentagon, but it doesn't actually explain how. What we do know is that there are three contractors that allegedly benefited from Cunningham's purchased work. One of them, we're confident, is a company called MZM. This is the company that we know from earlier this summer did this sort of undervalue of his house, bought the house at an exorbitant price and sold it at a big loss a few months later. MZM is a software firm that does this sort of sophisticated thing called data mining, which is looking at public databases to try and spot terrorist activity patterns. We know that this company's business has grown something like sixfold in defense contracting from about $10 million a year to about $60 million a year in the last couple of years. So that's the evidence that we have that Cunningham's efforts paid off for MZM.
Does it appear that the contractors, the people who allegedly did the bribing that he has confessed to, are going to be indicted?
That I'm not sure about. That they were tight-lipped about that out in California yesterday. They didn't really say how that was going to work. My guess would be that they were going after the elected official first, and that perhaps they might have cut some sort of lesser plea bargain arrangement potentially with some of these contractors to in return for their cooperation against the public official, because the Justice Department really wants that sort of a top priority of theirs, is to get a public official if they can.
Then the question arises, I guess, as to whether a or how a single congressman, you say he's number four amongst Republicans on the committee, there are still three above him, and of course there are a lot of other people involved in this process as well. How can a single person bestow favors on an individual company? How does that work?
Well, it's an enormous amount of money that's at stake each year, something on the order now of $400 billion. And if you've got nine Republicans in the House and about six Democrats essentially writing this budget, there's an equivalent number in the Senate, that's a relatively small universe of lawmakers that is having control over a significant amount of money to the taxpayer. Now, you compare $400 billion with the number I just threw out there, about $60 million, that's to the Pentagon budget something of a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Pentagon obviously knows who is writing its budget in Congress, and they pay extremely close attention to the priorities and the wish lists of those members, and they will bend over backwards to try and do what one of those members says. And if a member of Congress goes to a Pentagon procurement official and says, I've got a company in my district, or I've got a company that I know well that can do this kind of work, please take a close look at them, they, of course, will. They will, the Pentagon, I mean, and in that sense, it's legal. I mean, the Pentagon will go the extra mile to make sure that the congressman's favorite business is at least given a fair hearing.
So then not only does the bribing contractor benefit, but presumably the Pentagon does too, not necessarily in that regard, but with whatever else it might want from Congress, maybe not directly related to whatever the congressman got bribed for.
That's right. It's a bit of a, not to be too crass about it, but it's playing defense on the part of the Pentagon. You don't want to do something. The Pentagon does not want to do anything overt or go out of their way to annoy this relatively small group of lawmakers that holds their purse strings, so that they will curry favor with these men and women, and in return they get generally very pro-defense, pro-defense
okay.
hawk budgets.
All right. We will see how many more names emerge from all of this, or whether other congresspeople or lobbyists might be involved. Meantime, David Hawkins, thanks a lot for being with us.
Nice to be with you.
Managing Editor, Congressional Quarterly. In a moment, America's Melting Pot and the Politics of Immigration on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Marvin Olney back with To the Point. 4 years after September 11th, President Bush has returned to the issue of immigration reform. At the Mexican border with Texas today, he repeated his call for a crackdown, along with a so-called guest worker program.
We need to have a rational, temporary workers plan that is not amnesty. Amnesty would be a mistake. Granting amnesty to the people who've come to our country illegally would invite others to come to our country illegally. On the other hand, a temporary worker program would take pressure off our border.
Again, the president speaking today in Texas. According to recent polls, the president's call for action comes none too soon. Carol Doherty is Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Always good to have you on our program.
Good afternoon.
How concerned are Americans about illegal immigration?
Well, it's a divisive issue, but the one thing they can agree on is that the government's not doing enough. A CBS poll last month found that 75% said that the government wasn't doing enough to crack down on illegal immigration. Our own polling has found that it's an increasing priority for the public, up from 97. 51% now say it should be a top foreign policy priority, up from 42% in 97. So it's emerging as a real concern among the public.
What about this dual approach to having the crackdown at the same time that there is a guest worker program, a temporary program, as the president calls it? Are you able to poll on whether or not there's support for both of those things?
Well, there's a lot of support for a crackdown. Certainly, I think the public is very responsive to that, and I think President Bush's own party in particular is very responsive to that. A little more problematic is the guest worker program. We polled on that in March and found that 50% favored it. and 44% were opposed. But within Republicans, you see a real stark divide where you have economic, primarily these people we identified as economic conservatives, 70% or so say it's a good idea compared to only about 45% of social conservatives. So there's a split in President Bush's own party.
How would you define the social conservatives as opposed to the economic conservatives? What do you mean by that?
Well, these are people who agree with large parts of the GOP agenda, but their intensity of agreement is strongest on the social issues, gay marriage, abortion, things like that.
And they don't like the idea of the temporary worker program as much as they do the crackdown.
Right, exactly. Generally, what we see on immigration, it's really not so much of a partisan issue. You see education and economics really being influential on this. Well-educated people who make over $7,500 a year, are very tolerant about immigration. Generally, members of both parties are. It's when you get down to high school educated people, they're very skeptical of it, and understandably, because they feel their jobs are at stake with greater immigration.
There are other issues, obviously, involved, national security, human rights, as far as the immigrants themselves are concerned, the cost of social services. Do all those things play a role in the polling, and are people confused by them all?
Well, I think there are a lot of conflicting impulses. After all, this is a land that was built on immigrants, and I think people, by and large, have a favorable view of immigrants. It's just illegal immigration. There is a growing sense that it's out of control. In terms of the societal impact, it's generally favorable, but there is concern over jobs.
Back to the question of the president's sort of dual approach on this, does it appear that he's in a position to form a consensus for both the crackdown and the guest worker program?
I think he's got a tough sell. What we've seen in polling so far is that even his own party is very suspicious of the approach he's taken to date. As you know, he still attracts though his overall approval ratings have been declining of late. Still attracts great loyalty among Republicans, but just 36% of Republicans approve of the job he's doing on immigration. That's very poor. There's a lot of skepticism out there, and a lot of it's driven by this populism within the party that really wants the crackdown on immigration, on illegal immigration, but not so much the guest worker program.
Carol Daugherty, always good to have you with us, and thanks for being with us today.
Mm-hmm.
Associate Director of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. Daniel Griswold is Director of the Cato Institute's Center for Trade Policy Studies, author of a number of studies on trade and immigration. And Daniel Griswold, good to have you back on our show.
Glad to be with you.
The president is adopting, as I understand it, something that in outline is very similar to what you at Cato have proposed.
I think that's correct. We published a study about 3 years ago that said you're not going to fix this problem with enforcement alone. It's driven by some fundamental economic and demographic issues. We continue to create demand for lower-skilled jobs, and at the same time, the pool of Americans willing and happy to take those jobs continues to shrink, and yet there's no legal channel in our immigration system for workers to come from Mexico and other countries and fill these jobs, so we have large-scale illegal immigration. We've tried enforcement. You know, if our experience at the border teaches us anything, it's that enforcement alone is doomed to fail. We've increased spending tenfold since the late 80s. The president noted in his speeches how much that's increased even under his watch. And yet we've got 11 million people here illegally, the number growing by 500,000 each year, and perverse consequences, you know, deaths at the border, people staying here longer than they would otherwise because of the expense and the risk. I think the president's got it about right. Tough enforcement wedded with real immigration reform. Either one on its own is not going to work. The two together, I think, are our best chance to solve this problem.
All right. That question of real immigration reform is the one, it seems to me, that we need to debate a bit longer on. Mark Krikorian is Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a group based in Washington that researches the impact of immigration. And Mark Krikorian, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Warren.
Is this real immigration reform?
No, it's not, because it's mixing enforcement, which the president really isn't all that committed to anyway. It's really just more a rhetorical issue for him, with a guest worker program and an amnesty for the illegals who are here. And all that's going to do, regardless of whether you like the word amnesty or not, legalizing the illegals who are here and creating these legal channels that the president talks about to funnel even more people into the country are not going to take pressure off the border. They're not going to shrink the haystack that we're looking in the needle for. You know, we're looking for the terrorist or the gang member. All it's going to do is overwhelm the immigration service and spark even more illegal immigration. Today's illegal immigration wave from Mexico is the result of the last guest worker program we did in the 40s and 50s and early 60s called the Bracero program. Because the fact is that, number one, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary worker, and immigration always creates more immigration. And if you let in a lot of guest workers, a lot of them are going to stay, and they're going to suck in a lot of people in parallel flows of illegal aliens. There's just no way to avoid that, and the entire history of the immigration issue here and overseas finds no exception to those rules.
What would real immigration reform look like, according to you?
Well, what we need to do is get away from this idea that there's only two choices. One is deport everybody who's here tomorrow, which we couldn't do if we wanted to, or surrender and create a guest worker program, which is what the president and others want to do. The fact is, there's a third way, and that is attrition through enforcement. We start enforcing the law in a way that we have never done before. Dan says that we've tried enforcement, spent a lot of money on it, didn't work. All we've done is improve our infrastructure at the border, and even there, it's still laughably inadequate. But you can't, border enforcement can't work on its own. You need to have interior enforcement, especially denying jobs to illegal aliens. And that's something that we not only have not increased, we've actually gone backwards. Last year, only three employers were fined for hiring illegal aliens. Until we have real interior enforcement, we're not going to, you can't say that enforcement doesn't work because we've never tried it.
Mark Krikorian, Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies, back to Daniel Griswold at Cato. What do you say to that? The real enforcement hasn't taken place.
Well, I don't know how you can say increasing the spending on a program tenfold and line watch hours have gone up eightfold and President
Bush. Yeah, but that's just at the border, according to Krikorian. He's saying what you really need to do is crack down on the employers.
We've done that. In years past, we have fined hundreds of employers, and it hasn't made one whit of difference. We could raid every other chicken processing plant and discount retailer from coast to coast, and it would not address the fundamental problem, and that is our economy continues to create jobs, and that's not a problem. That's a good thing. It's a sign of the vibrancy of our economy, and yet Americans are getting older and better educated, so we've got a fundamental problem. I think Mark's approach of just trying more of the same, but just somehow doing it differently this time, and then just continuing to live with millions of people here illegally, I think is unacceptable. We need to address this problem. I think the president's got the right approach. Recognize reality, create this legal channel. You won't have more immigrants. You'll just have them coming here legally rather than illegally, coming across our borders of entry. And that way we can concentrate our enforcement firepower on the small share who come here with criminal intentions.
Mark Krikorian, you say we could have attrition through enforcement. What do you mean by that? Could you really slow the flow, given what the economy is doing and the appeal that it has to people south of the border?
Sure. I mean, the economy isn't some static thing. It's a dynamic system, and it demands its demands for labor can adjust and change. And what we've seen is with the arrival of huge numbers of workers and the expectation that huge numbers more will come, industries are actually distorted. Labor markets develop in different ways. Just as a quick example, in California, the acreage that's planted in labor-intensive crops, as opposed to crops that can be harvested by machine, has been going up because there's more and more servile labor to do that work, rather than what would happen with a gradual restriction in the number of foreign workers. It's not something that happened immediately. It would take a period of years. What would happen is that farmers would start changing their calculations. You'd end up with more carrots being planted and fewer strawberries. You'd end up with investments in harvest mechanization instead of simply relying on old-fashioned ways of, you know, hand-picking. Those kind of things, the economy adjusts, and in fact, what happens is that the superabundance of this low-skilled labor actually slows the process of technological development and productivity increases in those industries where they're concentrated because employers don't have any incentive to invest in those kind of productivity-improving advances.
Daniel Griswold, what do you say to that?
Well, I think Mark should talk to some of the growers out in California about this superabundance. Actually, there's a shortage of farm workers, and there are crops rotting on the vine. That's bad for Americans as consumers. It's bad for agriculture in California. You know, Mark mentioned the Bracero program a few moments ago, and there were certain aspects of that program that we shouldn't repeat. It was a failed program in a lot of ways, but one of the positive lessons we can learn from the Bracero program is that in the 50s, we faced a similar problem. We had illegal immigration, people sneaking across the border. We significantly increased the number of Bracero visas available, and illegal immigration dropped dramatically. We didn't get increased illegal immigration. We got reduced illegal immigration because there was this legal channel for them to come in, even under an imperfect program. And what the president is proposing is something far better than the Bracero guest worker program. It's a temporary worker program where they have mobility across sectors, so you don't get the employer abuses that you had back then. So I think if we increase legal immigration, we have good evidence that we'll reduce illegal immigration. I think that's what we all want.
Daniel Griswold of the Cato Institute, we'll come back to you. Also to Mark Krikorian of the Center for Immigration Studies. Want to get another view on this right now. Angela Kelly is Deputy Director at the National Immigration Forum. And Angela Kelly, good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks, Warren.
You're generally supportive of immigration. Let me ask you this about the president's program. It relies, as we heard him say himself a moment ago, on what he calls a temporary worker program. Is that realistic? Are people going to, after 3 years, or if they get extended after 6 years, going to come and turn themselves in and say, okay, I'm going home now, and then I'm going to apply later to come back, as the president suggests? Would that work?
Well, I think you're pointing to exactly the questions that we have about the president's program. I generally agree with Dan that it's in the right direction, but it's so short on the details that it's really hard to know whether, in fact, it'll work. You're raising the right question, though. Will people come forward to basically report themselves to be deported over time? These are folks who've been living in this country for many years. They have families. They have children in school. They have jobs. They've purchased homes. And it's not likely that they would come forward to work for a few years knowing that they would have to then return for a few years. And similarly, employers would have difficulty with that because that would mean their labor force is constantly leaving, making it hard for them, of course, to make investments in those folks. I mean, what the president doesn't talk about that he's going to need to over time, because the Senate, for example, is way ahead of him on this, is what do we do about the 11 million undocumented people that are here? They're not going to go away. It's impossible to deport them, as Mark himself says. And I think attrition is sort of a pathetic and paltry solution, quite frankly. When you're talking about 11 million people, it'd be something that my great-grandchildren would be having to deal with. And I think America can do better by putting people in a program where they have to come forward, they have to report themselves, show themselves, be screened, be taxed, have to show that they're working and keep their noses clean, of course, learn English. But over time, give them the chance to earn residency.
Angela Kelly with the National Immigration Forum. We will be back with all of our guests. We'll also talk about the impact on politics, and particularly Latino politics, with the outreach that the Republican Party has promised to that part of the electorate. A little later on our reporter's notebook, we'll be talking about Iraq and whether the police forces there are able to maintain order in a divided country. Will that be possible anytime soon in preparation for American troop withdrawal? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about illegal immigration. The president's call, once again, for a combined program involving a crackdown at the border, the Mexican border particularly, of course, and combining that with a so-called guest worker or temporary worker program, which would apply for either 3 years or 6 years, depending on whether there were an extension in an individual case, where workers could be here as, again, temporarily and then return to their home countries and apply to come back. Again, Angela Kelly at the National Immigration Forum is saying she doesn't think that's a realistic proposal. You also said that the attrition by enforcement mentioned by Mark Krikorian of the Center for Immigration Studies was a paltry solution to the problem. What do you mean by that?
I mean that we've already have put so many resources at the border, and we haven't gotten a handle on the problem. We've got 11 million folks in this country, and they're dispersed, quite frankly, and we see the effects from the Midwest to both coasts, where we need to have a program for bringing people out of the shadows and having them come forward. These are people who are working here. They're building their lives here. They're raising their families here. And they're not going to just simply go away. And cracking down on them at the workforce, if it's, you know, the Walmarts or the mom-and-pop shop in my hometown, it's just not conceivable given the numbers of people who are here.
Mark Krikorian, back to you with the Center for Immigration Studies. What about that, and what about the idea of bringing these people out of the shadows, a phrase used by the president?
Well, you hear about advocates for a guest worker program and amnesty talk about how realistic their proposals are, but the fact is there's only one realistic approach, and that's not rounding up everybody tomorrow. And it's also not this idea that the Immigration Service, which is choking on immigration and is completely incapable of processing the paperwork it has now, is somehow going to accurately screen and vet 11 million people. I mean, it's laughable when you actually think about it. The only realistic solution is to understand that it took us several years to get into this pickle, and it's going to take us several years to back out of it. And enforcing the law inside the country, nobody's really addressed this. All we keep talking about is the money spent at the border, which is, to some degree, which isn't irrelevant, but it's only a piece of the puzzle. What we can do is increase the number of people deporting themselves. This happens every year anyway. And decrease the number of new illegal aliens settling here. And we've seen this actually
work. Increase the number of people deporting themselves,
giving up and leaving. Because they can't find a job, and they can't open a bank account, and they can't live a normal life in the United States. Right now, it's not that hard to live a normal life in the United States as an illegal alien. Illegal aliens testify before state legislatures. They have their pictures and names and addresses in the newspaper. The idea that illegal aliens are living in the shadows is really kind of, an exaggeration at best.
Okay, let me get back to Angela Kelly on this one. What do you say to that? And do you think that if it were possible, as Mark Krikorian is saying, to change the economy in such a way that there wouldn't be as many jobs, would that help to deal with this issue? Would people then be discouraged from coming?
There are 500,000 people who come every year now. We have 5,000 legal visas annually for people in the service sector, for the hotels, for the restaurants. And there's such a gross mismatch between the demand for the labor that we have for these folks and the number of legal visas that are available for them. The demand is going to continue. We need these folks. We simply don't have enough workers. Our economy has been booming.
You don't think we can change the economy in the way that Mark Krikorian suggested earlier?
It's a massive economy. I mean, we clearly need these folks. They're not coming here and getting on welfare. They're not eligible for any welfare. They're not coming here and getting manicures. They're giving manicures. These are people who are making valuable contributions to this country. And it just seems ludicrous to think that they're going to leave on their own. I have been working in the community for years. I have never heard of anybody self-deporting.
Okay, let me go back to Daniel Griswold again with Cato. You said yourself that you don't think the Mark Krikorian's idea is a good one. But what about the idea of temporary workers and the overwhelming work for the Immigration Service that would be required if this program of the president's went into effect?
Well, first, every proposal for a temporary worker program includes fees, and a legalization program would include a fine. So it's not amnesty. They'd pay a fine, and that would generate tremendous resources for handling this administratively. Look, we have 1 million people entering the United States every day, 30 million separate people, individual people every year. We can handle large numbers of people coming and going. It's just they have legal documents, and they're doing it in a safe, orderly, legal way through established ports of entry. So I don't think administration is a problem. And to get to the idea of should it be temporary or should it be permanent, I think there's a demand there for temporary workers, both on the demand and the supply side. A lot of these jobs, people come and go anyway. There's a lot of turnover. And historically, you know, from the mid-60s to the mid-80s, we didn't have a legal channel to come through, but we didn't enforce it either. And what we found is the large majority of Mexicans who came here to work went back to Mexico. After all, that's the country where they were born and raised. That's where their friends and family are. I think there's a demand for circular movement, and the president has said, let's increase the number of green cards so that those who have family, who have shown their worth to their employer and their communities, can apply for permanent legal residence. Doesn't mean they jump the queue. They get in line with everybody else. I think you handle those two issues separately. I think a temporary worker program is the right approach. While expanding the opportunities to settle here legally, we should welcome people who have commitment to the work ethic and faith and family. We should welcome them to settle here permanently.
Daniel Griswold with the Cato Institute said we would talk about politics. I want to do that now. Our next guest is Larry Gonzalez. He's Washington Office Director of the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, NALEO, an organization, I might add, that is growing in numbers as we speak. Larry Gonzalez, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here. Thanks.
The Republican Party has talked about outreach to the Hispanic population, and President Bush has said that that would be one of the major hallmarks of his presidency. He said that, of course, before September 11th, when he was meeting with President Fox of Mexico, that issue having been dropped pretty much in the meantime until now, it's coming up again. How do you think this is going to affect the Latinos in this country, particularly those who are citizens and are able to vote?
I don't think there's any question that the Republican Party is committed to continuing to make inroads in the Hispanic community in the United States. But at the same time, when you talk about this issue, I mean, look, we've been doing town halls and forums all across the country. And when you ask Hispanic voters about the immigration issue, very rarely does it poll as a top priority. But at the same time, I think many voters, as well as other immigrants, listen to how it's being debated. And I think that's the most important thing that the Republican Party, as well as the president, needs to pay attention. I think the president gets it. But oftentimes what you have is these consultants and pollsters who say, well, you know, it's okay because our results show us, our data shows us that even legal immigrants are opposed to illegal immigration. Well, of course that's true. I don't think anyone in the Hispanic community can truly defend those who are lawbreakers, and resentment is particularly high among those who played by the rules. And so I think what's really missing, however, is the question of intensity. And you'll see often folks in swing districts, congressional districts, and local races as well, statewide races, where folks feel that flouting the word illegal is often, you know, sort of the magic bullet that will get them over the top to win an electoral contest. So I think that's what folks are really going to be paying attention to. And oftentimes Hispanics hear these attacks and believe that there are attacks on them. So, I mean, sometimes you hear these discussions, whether it's on the radio or on television, where, say, a discussion around day laborers all suddenly turns into an anti-Hispanic free-for-all. And I think that's really what folks need to be talking about. And Hispanics themselves really understand the experience that, for the most part, people really can't tell the difference between legal and illegal immigrants, or in a lot of cases between immigrants and U.S.-born Spanish-speaking Hispanics.
Where are the parts of the country where this makes the most difference? Where are there the most Hispanic voters and the most members of your organization, the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials?
Well, you know, the crazy thing, Warren, is that there's conflict all over. It really depends on where you're at. I mean, more recently we've seen in Houston, where there's a resolution that's moving quickly, talking about stepping up local enforcement efforts against illegal immigrants, cutting off benefits. Los Angeles is kind of down the middle of the road in terms of what they want to try to do. If you go to New York City has a bit more of an open policy. So it really depends on what area you're talking about. Most of our members, of course, are in the Southwest and California and Texas. And I think many of them are conflicted. As elected officials, of course, they're sworn to uphold the law, and they see, you know, what's going on. I don't think any of them are in a position to, again, to defend those who are seen as breaking the law. So they're conflicted as well on this issue.
Our first guest, Carol Doherty of the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press, said that this is not really a partisan issue completely, that it also has to do with educational and economic differences between various groups that they poll. I'm just interested in your take on that and whether if there's a sort of requirement for sensitivity here, it applies as much to Democrats as it does to Republicans. Larry Gonzalez?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I thought you were asking.
No,
absolutely. And there's no question that we've seen in other areas of the country where, again, it's used in a way by both parties. and it's being seen as sort of this magic bullet that will move a needle either to the right or to the left to help determine an election, all things being equal. So there's no question that one party has, you know, the will over the other, particularly in relation to this issue.
Larry Gonzalez, the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, want to raise another issue. It has been proposed by some that there be a statutory change that changes the provision, which is based, I guess, in law on the 14th Amendment, but they're arguing that you could pass a statute and change it. The provision whereby people born in this country get automatic citizenship, and I want to ask Mark Krikorian about this, Executive Director of the Center for Immigration Studies. Some congressmen have been saying that they could pass a law to repeal that idea or that provision. Again, I don't want to get too much into the legalism here because it's kind of complicated, but there are several congressmen that are talking about this and saying that if that were to happen, then you wouldn't get automatic citizenship, then fewer people would want to bring their families, you wouldn't have the issue of education and health and welfare and so on. Is that something that you would propose?
Well, I mean, I understand people's outrage at the idea that lawbreakers come here and are able to have children who are U.S. citizens. And in fact, it's almost 10% of all the babies born in the entire United States are born to illegal alien mothers. So it's a big issue. On the other hand, it's not a high I don't think we should list that as our first priority in trying to get control over immigration, because if we leave the rest of the immigration system broken, but change the interpretation of the Constitution so that women, babies born to illegals aren't citizens, we're going to end up with 400,000 illegal aliens born in the United States every year. And that's not a solution. It seems to me the solution is reduce illegal immigration dramatically, and then you can look at changing the constitutional provision, which may at that time be a good idea. It certainly shouldn't be the thing we do first. My fear, though, is that the open borders libertarians and the supporters of guest worker programs are actually going to support that measure as a way of getting a sort of duping conservatives into supporting guest worker programs, because they'll say, well, we'll let them in, but we won't let them become citizens, which is essentially the political agenda of the Know Nothing Party back in the 1800s, which was let in lots of people from overseas. They were a pro-immigration group. They just wanted to make sure nobody became U.S. citizens.
Angela Kelly, National Immigration Forum, your take on this debate, which seems to be forming, at least in some parts of the Congressional Caucus, the Republican Caucus in Congress.
Yeah, it's an issue that's been around for a long time and, quite frankly, doesn't ever get much traction. I mean, from just a legal standpoint, it would be unconstitutional. It would be such a major shift and require us to alter the Constitution, which is something that we really shouldn't do lightly. And there's been pretty solid analysis that says that these bills are just, you know, should be struck down because they're unconstitutional and shouldn't move forward. And then I quite frankly agree with Mark that you're simply adding to the undocumented population if you do take away the ability of people to become citizens when they're born. And, you know, finally, it would just really undermine who we are as a nation. I mean, that you're born here, that you belong, and that you can build a better life for yourself is really kind of our fundamental character. And there's often just a misunderstanding of how immigration law works. I mean, look, if I am illegal here and I have a child, it's 21 years before that child can apply for me to get legal status. So there's no benefit that's being conferred on the parent from an immigration standpoint because they have a child here. So it would only add to the undocumented population. It doesn't really fix the problem, and it's, quite frankly, unconstitutional.
But people argue that some parents come here illegally in the hope that their children will be born here and become citizens and there have a better life. Isn't that part of the motivation for coming to the United States?
It would be a very small percentage, I think, that come here simply for that reason. People are coming here to work. They come here and they are employed and they're making contributions.
Okay.
It is not coming here to simply have children because, again, they don't get a benefit for that.
Larry Gonzalez, back to you with the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials. I'm sure you're following all of this in Congress, and we've heard already that there are a lot of options, including one we just mentioned, and that there are a difference between the Senate and the Congress on this as well. What's your take on what the future of the president's program is likely to be?
I think he's definitely going to get pushback from his own party. I think, you know, the Democrats need to figure out what exactly they want. There's some bills out there that seem very workable, like Senator McCain and Senator Kennedy's offering, as well as Congressman Gutierrez and Jeff Flake and Jim Colby's offering in the House. But right now, the initial pushback seems to be from the Republican side, save a few members that are talking about a comprehensive approach. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic, and we're only a few short months away from entering the election season, if it hasn't started already. So it's even more of an interesting dynamic from that perspective.
Very quickly, I want to go through the list of guests, if I can, in the few moments we have remaining. Mark Krikorian with the Center for Immigration Studies. You're the hardliner on this program. What do you think is the fate of the president's program?
Well, I mean, if I had to bet a lunch on this, what I would bet is by the end of next year, when the 109th Congress ends, the House will have passed an enforcement bill, the Senate will have passed a guest worker amnesty bill, and then the whole thing will fall apart in the conference committee where they try to come up with a common version, and they're not going to succeed, and they'll have to start all over again in 2007.
Daniel Griswold with Cato, what do you think about the politics of this?
Well, maybe it's more wishful thinking, but I think there is a working majority in Congress to pass something along the lines of what the president's talking about. I think it's a noisy minority within the Republican Party that wants no legalization program to follow the failed enforcement-only policies of the past. The president, let's give him credit. He's shown leadership on this. He is apparently willing to take on some of the elements within his own party. So I think we've got a chance, maybe not a probability, but I think a chance of fixing this problem once and for all.
Okay, quickly, Angela Kelly, what do you think about this? Are there enough Democrats, do you think, that feel perhaps more of the way you do and the way Daniel Griswold does to give the president what he wants?
I do. I think there are a number of Democrats who are in the right place on this issue. I think there's also a number of Republicans that are coming forward on it. And I don't know if it's so much what the president wants, but, you know, if you look to the Senate, there are, quite frankly, more Republican senators than there are Democrats that have come forward with solid proposals on this. So I think, you know, Dan's right. The House is less organized. They act more like romper room. I think that the Senate can be more stately, more like a boardroom, and that they can get something through. And at the end of the day, the public is going to demand reform because the system is so unworkable as it stands.
All right. Remembering the House of Representatives as romper room, we're out of time. Thank you all. Angela Kelly with the National Immigration Forum, Larry Gonzalez with the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, Mark Krikorian, the Center for Immigration Studies, Daniel Griswold with the Cato Institute, and Carol Doherty, our earlier guest, with the Pew Research Center for the People and the Press. A lot of talk about what the president might be saying tomorrow about the possibility of withdrawing from Iraq. We'll see what he had to say today about all of that, and talk also about reports that there have been infiltration of some of the Iraqi security forces by Shiite Muslim death squads. All that on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Foreman Alney back with Popota's Notebook on To the Point. There have been more and more calls in Washington for pulling out of Iraq, or at least establishing a timetable for pulling out of Iraq. President Bush will make a speech on this subject tomorrow, and there's been a lot of speculation that he'll be sort of trying to prepare the country for the possibility of withdrawal. Today, he didn't sound that way.
Now, I know there's a lot of voices in Washington. We've heard some people say, pull them out right now. That's a huge mistake. It'd be a terrible mistake. It sends a bad message to our troops, and it sends a bad message to our enemy, and it sends a bad message to the Iraqis.
President Bush is speaking today in Texas. Secretary Rumsfeld today also said that we should be looking at the progress that the Iraqis are making in establishing their own security forces, including police forces. Jonathan Landay is a senior national security correspondent for Knight Ridder. And Jonathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
How much has this added to our understanding of what the president is likely to say tomorrow?
I think what we're going to hear probably is enunciation of policy, and that is the idea that the United States cannot leave until it has trained up enough Iraqi security forces that are capable of functioning on their own in terms of being able to maintain security in that very violent country.
So trained up enough then becomes the phrase that you have to look at closely. Who has any standard as to determining when that's the case?
It's very hard to define. We've seen various standards being trotted out over the last several years in terms of the numbers of troops that are trained, the numbers of divisions, the numbers of brigades. When the American rating system was recently applied to the Iraqi army, we saw that three fully capable brigades became one. And so it's very hard to say. Most officers, I've just been spoken to officers who've come back, say there's definite improvements, absolutely definite improvements in the capabilities of the Iraqi forces, but there are also very serious gaps that remain.
What kind of gaps? What does that mean?
Well, for instance, look at logistics. The ability of the Iraqi army to provide its own logistics, keep itself supplied in ammunition, in food, to be able to move around. That is an area where they're lacking. It's one that, in fact, the United States fills for them. Aircraft, air power, they basically have none. They count almost exclusively on American American air power. The other is in officers and non-commissioned officers. In terms of officers, trained up, capable officers, there's a very large shortage of trained up Iraqi army officers. And finally, in what's called their capacity, their bureaucratic capacity, the ability of the defense ministry to actually manage and run this very large armed force is said by many experts to be still very deficient.
Jonathan Landay, once again, senior national security correspondent for Knight Ridder. Your paper, Los Angeles Times and others have been reporting in the past few days about what they describe as Shiite Muslim militia members infiltrating the police force and carrying out sectarian killings under the color of law. The Shiites, of course, the majority in the country, suppressed for many decades by the Sunnis, particularly under Saddam Hussein. To what extent does that undermine the effort by the United States to turn things over to the Iraqis?
I think it's a very serious issue. In fact, we reported, one of our reporters several weeks ago, embedded with what was touted to be one of the centerpiece Iraqi brigades, one of the most capable. It's an Iraqi brigade that runs its own checkpoints in a section of Baghdad, and he spent a week with them, eating, sleeping, going out on patrol. Bottom line of the story was a very chilling one. This was a brigade of Shiites who could not wait to be able to exact revenge on Sunnis in the neighborhoods under their control for killings of their comrades and other Shiites. The fact is that one doesn't know. This is another very major question about the Iraqi army: is what is the percentage of Shiites in the army versus Sunnis versus Kurds? It's a figure that's not accessible and raises serious concerns about what that army, which is trained and armed by the United States, could do if it is in fact overwhelmingly Shiite and comes under the control, full control of a Shiite government, a Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad.
Now, you mentioned the possibility that Shiites are exacting revenge on Sunnis. Presumably that would be for decades of repression, but it's also for the insurgency, is it not, which has targeted a lot of these very same Shiites that are trying to train and become members of the police force in the army?
Well, Shiites in general have been targeted not just by the Sunni insurgents, but by the foreign Sunni extremists that have come in. Their mosques have been bombed. There have been assassinations. They've been targeted by a lot of violence, and it's only natural to see that the desire to get revenge for that added to the desire to get revenge for what happened during the decades of rule by Saddam to the Shiites. And there's one quote from the story I was just talking about that really stands out, which is from a senior officer in this brigade that says, "We will never again let them have this country. This is our country," meaning the Sunnis.
That's an officer in one of the brigades touted as being the best trained, the best able to take over security responsibilities.
Yes.
Have the Americans, other than the military people that you've talked to, have the civilians in the Pentagon, Secretary Rumsfeld and others, acknowledged all of this?
I haven't heard anybody asking the secretary point blank about the communal question, the religious division question as it pertains to the Iraqi security forces. And when people do ask the military for statistics on the breakdown of, you know, what is the percentage of Shiites recruited to the army in the general army troops, or and in the officer corps and the non-combat and the non-commissioned officers, there's no answer as far as I can tell. There has been no breakdown, and so that's why it is a very serious question.
So no convenient place to go and look. No rosters available with
indicated. I'm sure there are, but the question is, what would it show you? I mean, one of the things that has been we had a story yesterday about this. This jail where these Sunnis were allegedly kept incarcerated and were abused. Well, two police officers told our correspondent there that the jail was run by the Badr organization. Now, this is a Sunni militia, an Iranian-backed militia that is the armed wing of one of the country's most influential Shiite political parties.
Jonathan Landay, complicated situation, national security correspondent for Knight Ridder. Thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Today's program produced by Sherman Rimbaum with Christian Bordahl and Ileana Justice. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI. You just heard it.
International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.